is a
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Summer ended yesterday for children attending Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. It was the first day of school after a summer consumed with conversation and debate over teacher pay raises, teacher assistance, teacher tenure, the fate of Common Core standards, and more. All of that was taking place in Raleigh during the legislature's so-called short session, and many changes have resulted. Then last week, a court in North Carolina decided that vouchers for private schools were unconstitutional. That throws in doubt the fate of many students who depended on those vouchers to fund their private school education, and it has caused private and public schools to scramble to handle last-minute changes in student populations. We're going to talk about the impact of all that and more this hour with CMS Superintendent Dr. Heath Morrison. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I was going to ask you about how the first day of school went yesterday, and then I read in the paper that opening paragraph of the article, smoothest opening ever.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Ann Clark, our deputy superintendent, has seen a number of different CMS opening days, and she just, when we were debriefing at the end of the day, she just said it was one of the smoothest she'd ever seen, maybe the very best. We started off the day with 99.4% of all of our teachers hired, despite a very late budget. There was no transportation glitches, despite some construction issues that we had accounted for. And all the schools we visited, they're learning going on, teachers building relationships. So it was a really strong first day, and now we have to make sure we have 179 ones that are going to follow that.
How many 99 point what teachers?
99.4% of all of our teachers were hired. So we started off the day with about 64 vacancies. We got that down to 58, and we're trying to get the remainder of those hired by the end of this week, which is actually better than it's been the last several years.
I was going to ask you about that, too, because I don't understand that. We know when the first day of school is going to be, and we know it for months, years probably. So why is it that usually in that first week of school we don't have enough teachers to go around? We have to hire them in the first week or two.
Yeah, so a couple of things. So first of all, we didn't know what our salary schedule was going to be this year until the state budget was adopted. We knew what was being discussed, but until actually the state decided on the budget, it's hard to tell people to come work for you if you can't tell them a definitive salary schedule. So that proved a little challenging. The other part, too, was through the budget.
So teachers that you're talking to about potentially working here are actually willing to sit it out to say, okay, when you can tell me what you're going to pay me, I might come. Is that what they?
No, not so much. But again, when you've got a firm salary that you can put in front of folks. So, for example, we know that the Houston superintendent Terry Greer, formerly of North Carolina, made a lot of not only local but national attention about actively recruiting in the North Carolina region. Mm-hmm. He was talking about $50,000 starting teacher salary, so he could put that in front of a teacher and say, "Come to Houston." We could tell them what we thought our starting salaries were going to be, but until the final budget was adopted, we couldn't make that commitment. And again, at the end of the day, though people don't go into teaching for the money, certainly it is a job. And like any other job, I think you want to know what you're going to get paid before you agree to take the job.
So as I understand it, you're looking for about 74, before school started yesterday, 74 and a half teachers in math, science, career, and technical education. And this year, English teachers evidently are in short supply.
Not in short supply. It's just usually at this point of the year, if we are having vacancies, it's usually in those areas you articulated, math, science, career technology field, special education, English as a second language teachers. This year, for whatever reason, we just had a number of English vacancies, and so we're getting those filled. Again, when we started off the school day yesterday, we had 64 vacancies. We got that down to 58. I'm partial English teachers. I married one, so I know how valuable they are. But again, you know, the other challenge too is, again, until you know your budget, we tend to hold some positions back just in case in the budget process if we were to lose any teaching allocations. And so once we got a better sense of the budget was going to pass without cuts to teaching positions, then we started putting those positions out. But I think it does speak to one of the concerns that was raised at the end of the legislative session around a change in how growth has been funded traditionally in North Carolina. For decades in our state, if a district experienced growth as you went through your budget process, you could anticipate that and you could plan for it and you could allot those positions out to your schools and you could hire for them. Now that's not necessarily going to be the case. And so as we go forward, unless the legislature and the governor decides to change that, growth will be a priority, but not necessarily something that will have to be funded. And so finding out, for example, if we're going to grow 3,000 students, that's about 150 teachers. So to get those teachers several weeks before school starts, that will be challenging in the future.
Why did they set it up that way?
Again,
that sounds reasonable to me, that if you know you're going to grow,
yeah,
and you know you're going to need more teachers, then you know you're going to need more money, that the money, given the fact that every child has a right to and must be given an education, that the money must come.
So I think one of the things that was frustrating about the end of the session, and a lot of good things happened, and so I certainly want to give credit about the good positive things that happened, including some significant increases in teacher salary for many of our teachers. Right at the end of the session, there was a switch around how growth would be funded in the future, and it was with very little conversation, very little discourse. As we've reached out to talk to legislators, the only thing we've been told is it so that there could be more transparency. And the sense was that if a district were not to grow, then it looked like budgets were being cut. But, you know, I think most parents understand if the enrollment grows, you should have more teachers. If your enrollment declines, there's going to be fewer teachers. So I don't think any district that we've spoken to, large urban districts like CMS or smaller districts, rural, no one was sensing that this was an issue. So, again, for that large a change to happen, it is concerning. It's something we're continuing to talk to our legislators and the governor about.
A lot of things happened over the summer, and certainly a lot of things were talked about over the summer at the legislative level. And it would seem to me, if I were in the business that you're in, whether I was a teacher or a teacher assistant or a cafeteria worker for that matter, it would have been an emotional roller coaster. What has been the reaction of teachers, faculty, staff to the discussions that went on this summer in Raleigh?
You know, it varies, and it's been amazing for me. Last week I was able to visit several of our schools and get a chance to talk to all of our faculty and take questions. And then, of course, the last 2 days I've been in a number of different schools and talking to teachers, veteran, new teachers, administrators, support staff, bus drivers, secretaries. And it's very mixed. If you are a teacher earlier into your teaching profession, you're feeling pretty good about what happened and the paycheck that you think you're going to get when we issue our first paychecks with the new salary schedule. I think a lot of our veteran teachers feel very upset and disrespected. They feel like they've served North Carolina for a number of years. When we talk about North Carolina teacher pay being 48th in the country, and then you hear that there's going to be on average a 7% raise, and then you find out that you are going to get maybe as low as a 0.3% raise, you feel disrespected. And so, again, what I've said is how people feel about the teacher salary schedule depends on where you find yourself. And it's somewhat of a truism. The newer you are to the profession, the higher your rate increase is going to be. I think our support staff have been very interested because they heard what the state workers got. So if you're a secretary for the Department of Transportation or even the Department of Instruction for that matter, you're getting a $1,000 raise and 5 bonus days. If you're a secretary in CMS or Guilford County or Wake, you're getting $500 raise and no bonus days. And so I think a lot of our support staff have been concerned about the disparity between how state workers were treated and how they were treated. And so, again, it really depends on who benefited from the decisions that were made, how they feel about the ultimate decisions in Raleigh.
Let's go back to talk about this, because I didn't know this until yesterday, that you said just a second ago that employees of the system, not the teachers, the employees are getting a $500 a year raise, whilst employees at the State Board of Education who are similarly tasked are getting a $1,000 raise and 5 extra days of vacation. Why the discrepancy?
Again, you know, I'm not sure I'm in a position to answer that. A lot of those decisions were made at the end of the session. I'm sure what folks are going to say is that the money wasn't there.
But it was there for people in Raleigh.
Yeah, you know, so, and again, I do want to give...
And what do those people in Raleigh do? Because they're not connected to a school system or a school district. They are connected to the state board.
Yeah, so, for example, well, a secretary at the Department of Public Instruction. So the Department of Public Instruction is a state agency to support education. So a secretary that works for the State Department of Public Instruction would do very much the same as a secretary would at West Mecklenburg High School, Providence High School. So the jobs are very similar. There's nothing in terms of the job because you work for the state versus a school district, that would seem to indicate that there should be a disparity in terms of that level of pay. But again, those were the decisions that were reached. And so those are the things that become a little problematic as you're going out and mm-hmm. folks want to know why and ask the same question, why. And when you're not the decision maker, it's hard to be in that situation to explain it. And so, you know, we're trying to get clarification in terms of what we should message on those topics.
There was a lot of discussion about teacher assistants in Raleigh this summer, and the legislature crowed that teacher assistant positions were saved in the final budget. Some believe that is not true. What is the case?
Yeah, you know, so I think, and again, I let me start off by saying that one of the things that I was very pleased about with the different budgets that came out, all of them included significant calls for teacher salary increases. And, you know, the governor's budget to the Senate's budget, and what ultimately the budget passed did have teacher salary increases and some significant teacher salary increases. So I definitely want to make sure I acknowledge that. One of the pain points throughout the budget, as you know, was around teacher assistance. And the largest salary increase of 11% that the Senate called for came with huge cuts to teacher assistance. The governor's came with no cuts. And so the whole session was about how many teacher assistants might be at risk. The ultimate budget that was passed, our lawmakers said, would necessitate no teacher assistant cuts. Now, here's the challenge. I think so much was happening at the very end. I think our lawmakers really thought that they had created a pathway for us to keep the same number of teacher assistants that we had last year. And it's complicated because there was a shift of teacher assistants from the general fund to lottery. There was $25 million of non-recurring money that was put in to mitigate that. There were some conversions of new teaching positions. So there was a lot. It was very complicated. We believe that there was a miscalculation in terms of conversion. So usually, rule of thumb, if you give up one teacher position, you can get two teacher assistants. And we think that the salary schedule of using the average teacher salary rather than the beginning teacher salary, we think costs around a $20 million gap. Not intentional. And we were very excited when actually the governor and the legislature started talking about a technical correction bill that would have allowed us to, we think, fix the problem. Unfortunately, that technical correction bill was not passed because it was tied to another piece of legislation that had nothing to do with teacher assistance. So ultimately for us, we think it was about a $1.6 million gap in funding.
So the bottom line is we don't have as many teacher assistants as we should have.
Well, we didn't. We don't believe that we were able to do what was put into legislation. What we did decide to do in Charlotte-Mecklenburg was to go into our savings, our fund balance, and use $1.6 million of that to make sure that we did not have to lose any of our teacher assistant allocations we'd already put out into our schools.
Now, when I went to school in the Pleistocene age, there were 50 kids in a classroom.
And were you using an abacus then?
Yeah. Okay. 50. No, we weren't allowed to have them in class.
Oh, very good.
Only
okay.
at home.
Pony Express, their cell phones, right?
And we walked uphill both ways.
5 miles.
Barefoot
in the
snow.
Yeah, I got it.
Anyway, we had 50 kids in the classroom and no teacher assistants.
Right.
So a lot of people today think, why does a teacher have to have an assistant? Why? Tell me why.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the big misnomers. We know in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, our teacher assistants are one of the most valued return on investments, we think, in the state. These are very highly skilled, trained folks. If you go into a great class and see a master teacher with a great teacher assistant, and sometimes it's hard to know which is the teacher, they allow for personalization of the learning environment. They allow for differentiation. While the teacher takes the students who learn the material, the teacher assistant can take the kids who are struggling, or vice versa. The teacher can take the kids who are struggling. The teacher assistant can move the instruction forward. They're incredibly valuable. Last year, when we had the Read to Achieve legislation, we were able to get 85% of our kids to pass. And that was through not only great teachers, but great teacher assistants.
CMS Superintendent Dr. Heath Morrison is with us for the hour. We have so much more to talk about, and we will. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's Labor Day celebration on Sunday, August 31st, featuring 5 and 15K trail races, the Quadzilla Relay Race, live music all day from Langhorne Slim, and more, plus a fireworks display. Details at usnwc.org. Opiate use is up nationwide, along with opiate overdoses, and that includes North Carolina, by the way. There is another drug, though, that can literally reverse the effects of an overdose if administered in time. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has urged federal law enforcement agencies to train and equip personnel in the use of this drug, but Mecklenburg County so far has not. So we're going to find out more about this opiate reversal drug, who has access to it, exactly how it works, and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the killing of teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, renews questions about police practices and the use of deadly force. Why some say Brown's death could spark a broader debate in U.S. police strategies.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Heath Morrison is here on the second day of school playing hooky already. he's the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. Teachers, as we've talked about, are getting pay raises as a result of negotiations in Raleigh at the state level. I don't know where I got these figures. I hope that they're right. Those with 5 years' experience will get an 18.5% raise. Teachers with 9 years will get a 10.5% raise. Those with 10 years get a 16.1% raise. Those with 14 will get 2%. Those with 15 years will get 9.9%. These seem odd intervals and odd numbers.
Yeah.
Why?
I think in fairness to our legislature, and I think the governor actually started on this endeavor, was we have a very complicated 37-step scale for teachers previously. And so the plan was to move to a six-banded growth area. So we went from 37 steps to six. And that conversion, along with really wanting to make sure that our beginning teacher salary schedule, which is where our lawmakers felt there was the most disparity between North Carolina and regional states, was addressed. And so, again, it's not absolutely true, but it does is a kind of a commonality. The newer you are to the profession, the higher your percentage rate increase is going to be.
So I'm a beginning teacher. Today is my second day in the classroom.
Right.
What do I make?
Well, the plan would be around $33,000 to go to $35,000 in the next legislative session before any local supplement would add to that.
And if I were teaching in Fort Mill or Columbia or someplace in Virginia, what would I be making on my second day in the business?
Well, what we know is, again, Terry Greer, superintendent in the Houston Unified School District, started off with $50,000 as a starting teacher salary. On average, we are about $7,000 below the national average in terms of starting teacher salary. So what we're going to have to see is what our salary schedules are now compared to other states, because just as we increase teacher salaries, many other states are doing so as well. And so we'll have to see how big that disparity is.
And what about these veteran teachers? Are they on par yet with others nearby states?
No, and I think that's part of the pain point, is that if I'm a veteran teacher and I'm not happy with the pay raise I got, and you've got Rock Hill in South Carolina calling with anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 more, it's very hard to resist that, to do the same job that you love doing here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. So, again, what I've said, and I do credit our legislature, I credit our governor for a good first step, but there's going to be more work that needs to be done around our teacher salaries and all educational employee salaries.
The county set aside a little more than $4 million to give teacher raises before they knew what the legislature was going to do. So when you figure in that money, which when you spread it out over all the teachers that you have is not much, but when you take that money into consideration, how much more will the teachers receive because of the county kicking in $4
million? Well, what the county allocated actually was about $7.3 million.
Okay.
And what happens, and sounds complicated, and it is, but the state gives a increase for all state employees and individuals that work in school districts that are paid by the state. If we're both at a high school, let's say we're over at Independence High School, we're both teaching math, you might get paid through local funds, I might get paid through state funding. So certainly I can't get an increase and you don't. And so what our local funders or county commissioners agree to do is to match whatever the state does. So we're still working out how much that's going to be. We actually believe that's going to be in excess of $11 million. So very hopeful that they're going to see fit to fund all of that. But that actually just gives everybody the same raise that the state committed to. Now, what our county commissioners have done is put a referendum on potential on the ballot with a sales tax initiative that will allow us to add to that, and we're optimistic that we'll be able to do more for all of our employees with
that. So you see, boys and girls, the bottom line here is that you need to do well in math to figure all of this
out. Get that abacus out.
Let's talk about that quarter-cent sales tax for education. The proposal has been levied, I think, by the county commission, and it first appeared that the legislature was going to squash that in favor of a uniform sales tax rate throughout the state, except they'd already made an exception in another county, so I think they let it go.
In two counties.
And so now it's going to come to a vote in November of the voters, and the tax that would be collected on this quarter-cent sales tax, how would you use that money if voters say yes?
Yeah, the quarter-cent sales tax that the county commissioners have agreed to put on the ballot, and again, I want to thank them for their leadership in that, and our school board has taken a strong position to endorse that. 80% of that would come to Charlotte-Mecklenburg explicitly and only for employee salaries. And so we believe in working with the county commissioners and Dina Diario, the county manager, that it would raise about $26 to $28 million just for CMS, about $35 million overall. The other beneficiaries would be CPCC, the Arts and Science Council, and libraries.
Do you think that muddies it up?
You know, I think there's going to be folks who are going to say
people see teacher salaries as, because of the case that you've made and others have made over the course of the summer, are being 48th in teacher pay in the nation. They see maybe a need for that quarter cent sales tax for that, but do they see it for the Arts and Science Council? Do they see it for the library?
Well, you know, I'm certainly going to hope so. I think they're all worthy organizations. You know, we have such a great partnership with all of those agencies, and we know they all help a better community and also in the education of our students, both at K-12 and higher ed. So I hope so, you know, but there are going to be some folks, I'm sure, that are going to say, hey, they all went to teacher salaries, or if it all went to CMS employees, then I'd be more favorable to it. I think there are going to be other folks who say, look, you know, I'm glad the Arts and Science Council is getting a portion, or libraries. So we hope it's going to resonate. What I know is it's needed. Getting back to the point we were talking about before, when the state gives a salary increase that is for all districts in the state of North Carolina, we know in Charlotte it is a little bit more expensive for our employees to live, to work, and so that ability to augment the local supplement to our employees is a boon. It makes North Carolina not only attractive but CMS attractive, and we want to have our best teachers come and stay and teach here in CMS.
You anticipated, I believe, 754 additional students this year. Has that come to pass?
We won't know. It's very early in the process when you're welcoming students back and you just see all the folks that are – I was just at West Mecklenburg. They had 100 students register yesterday. That was just in one day. So we have to get all the new students that are registering. Then, of course, there are going to be withdrawals and students moving to different schools. So it probably won't be until about the eighth day that we get a real sense of how many students, and then lock and load it by the 20th day.
Is that unusual that 100 students would register at a high school on the first day of school?
It was unusual.
What were they waiting for?
you know, I will tell you, when I was a high school principal, I used to joke with my guidance counselors. I felt like renting an ice cream truck and going out to the neighborhoods and – if you would just register, because we do such a better job for your child on the first day of school, and we know that they're coming, we can balance our classes and have a schedule ready. It's a phenomenon that happens all over the country where people wait until the last minute to register. But it's been more interesting this year. We've had a lot more late registrations all across our district, and so we're going to have to wait and see what that means.
For years, we had galloping growth in this area, but unlike previous years, where a lot of students came because they moved here over the summer from elsewhere, Deputy Superintendent Ann Clark says that much of this growth is due to keeping more students from dropping out and promoting people from the 9th to the 10th grade, which I guess is good news because you're keeping your retaining students.
Absolutely.
But what impact does that have when you actually are able to keep people in school and not drop out? What does that do to you?
Well, what it does for the community is it's a great return on investment. A high school dropout becomes an expensive proposition down the road because, unfortunately, a high school dropout, we know, unfortunately, the statistics you know, crime, social services that are needed, all sorts of expense. When we graduate a student, that tends to be a student that goes on to a productive career or college. And so the economic return on investment is huge. But for us, it's the ability to not have a student leave school to get that diploma that opens up doors. So I'm very proud of the last several years. Our dropout rate has dramatically decreased. Our graduation rate has continued to increase. We expect when we announce graduation rates for this past year that we're going to see another year, a sixth year in a row of graduation rate increases.
I sometimes look at the public schools as the whipping boy, as somebody who suffers from whiplash because we get to toy with you and ask you to do things and then pull the rug out from under you when you start. And one of those examples might be the fact that for the last several years you've been gearing up, as have systems across the state, to implement Common Core standards. And this summer, the legislature decided we aren't going to participate in that anymore. So what does that do to you?
I think the frustrating thing for our teachers and our school communities all across the country, we've been gearing up for the Common Core, this national set of standards in English, language arts, and math, so that we could better assess how we're doing as a nation in terms of educating our students. And so we've spent a lot of time, precious resources, money, training, and so our teachers are all set. And now it's in question. This year we will stay in the Common Core. The state legislature has decided there will be a committee that will be formed of educators and other civic-minded folks that will come together and assess Common Core. And it could be a minor tweak with a name change. It could be a major change to the standards. But as I said, Mike, one of the things that's frustrating is, you know, as superintendent, I like to give people a sense of how are we doing. And so we have to look at how we did last year on standards and assessments versus how we did this year on standards and assessment. In North Carolina, over the last 4 or 5 years, we have rapidly changed standards, changed assessments, changed how we value those assessments. It is really difficult to say from year to year how we're doing, and that's frustrating for the public. It's frustrating for our schools.
Because you can't compare year to year because the standards have changed.
The standards change.
An A this year may not have been an A last year.
Well, you know, what made a student proficient in reading last year changes all the time because the standards and the actual assessments change.
Why are we doing this, and when will it stop?
Well, you know, again, that's
and let me ask you this too, because you weren't going to answer that question anyway.
I don't know. You know, I hate to ever say, but I don't know. But you know, it's not the local school board that gets to make those decisions. What
right.
we have to do is once those decisions are made, we have to react to it locally.
The idea behind Common Core, as I understood it, was that school districts across the country, school systems statewide across the country, could then compare themselves, so we would know how North Carolina students were doing in comparison
Absolutely.
To other people who are also on the Common Core standards in Oregon or Minnesota or Texas, wherever. In the absence of that, we don't know, do we?
I think there are some things. For example, there's an assessment called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Last year, amongst the large urban districts, CMS was the highest performing on that. So there are some indicators. There's SATs, ACTs. But in terms of actual standards that assess math and reading and actual standards that are aligned to international tests, that is the thing that the Common Core was very promising in terms of having a more national focus.
Did your teachers, did your principals like Common Core?
You know, I think for the most part, I've heard a lot more positives than negatives. You know, I don't think any standards are perfect, and so all standards are subject to improvement. But I think most of our teachers and principals really look forward to a more rigorous set of standards and helping our students reach those more rigorous standards.
Did you like the curriculum more than you liked the testing, or was it equal?
Well, again, let's remember what the Common Core is are standards, okay? That's not a curriculum, and the Common Core themselves are not tests. There were two different types of tests that were being developed across the country, and so different states decided which of the tests that they were going to have to compare themselves against other states with the Common Core. So you have standards, you have curriculum, you have assessments. You know, I've been on record, and I feel very strongly about this. I think we test far too much, not allowing enough time to teach. But I'm a fan of the Common Core. I think overall, again, that there's not areas that they can't get better. But I think the preponderance of good for the Common Core far outweighs any concerns.
Let's talk about school safety, because this was high on the minds of parents last year because of several incidents that happened around the country. When parents send their kids off to school, they anticipate having them return in the evening and that they're safe while they're in your care. And it's an enormous responsibility for teachers and anybody involved in schools. You have made some substantial security enhancements over the last year or so. $20 million, if I'm not mistaken, in security upgrades across the system. What kinds of enhancements does $20 million pay for?
Yeah, so first of all, let me thank our county commissioners, the partnership with our school board. We went to them after the incredibly tragic events at Sandy Hook and said, look, you know, we feel like we're doing a lot of good things, but we feel we can do more. And thankfully, because in our 2007 bond campaign, all of our projects had come in on time and under budget, we had some savings. And so in partnership, we were able to put together a security plan of $20 million. And so what that allowed us to do was to add just a huge amount of cameras, have what we call single point of entrance, to where instead of having parents or community members visit a school and have multiple ways to get in school, they walk up to the door, they buzz to come in, and they identify their purpose for coming in. They come in, they sign in. So there's just a lot of things that we can do that we
feel. Are those doors solid or are they glass?
You know, they're different at each school. And so.
And if they're glass, does that really provide the needed security? Given the incidents that we've had at schools around the country.
You know, I think what was interesting at the Hood Hargett breakfast several weeks ago, we actually had a parent that came to speak to us whose child passed at Sandy Hook.
Right.
And I just an incredible person to be able to speak about that and her need to speak to it. And she was very complimentary of what she had learned about CMS and what we were doing, not just in terms of facility upgrades, but in terms of training. But, you know, here's the challenge, Mike. I don't know what you can do to keep schools totally safe. You know, we live in the most interesting of times and very frightening times where folks will target places of worship, places like malls, theaters, and schools. And, you know, the challenge is you build schools to welcome communities in. You build schools to welcome parents and children in. You don't build schools to be a fortress. And so you're in this delicate balance of you don't want people walking in and immediately feeling that their security is compromised by what you're trying to do to keep them safe. So, you know, if somebody comes in heavily armed like they did at Sandy Hook, you know, you're challenged in terms of what you can do. We are very lucky to have SROs, and we're very fortunate to have
SRO
the training school resource officers. And so, you know, it's not just the facility upgrades. It's the security forces that we have in our schools. It's the training that we do. We do active shooter drills. We're focused on social emotional learning needs this year so that as students are experiencing issues or challenges, we try to be very responsive. When we hear that there are potential security threats, we take them very seriously. But to your point, it is our most fundamental commitment is to keep our children safe.
Well, when that Sandy Hook mother spoke, you said in the aftermath of that you were paying very careful attention and that all the things that she said we should be doing, we are doing, and more. When a visitor comes to a school now, their ID is going to be checked against a database of sex offenders and violent criminals. Every single visitor is going to have that check done on them?
Isn't
that overkill?
So what happens is there's a distinction in our school district between a visitor and a volunteer. And so if you are the primary guardian or caregiver of your child, there's the same amount of information you need to register your child as what we require for you to have access to your child, your child's teachers, your child's record. Mm-hmm. For anybody that is going to be a volunteer, and so they're actually going to be in a trusting adult relationship with other people's children, we put them through an extensive background check to make sure that as far as we can tell that there are no issues or challenges. And so it can be logistically challenging a lot of times when people say, I want to volunteer, and there's a lot of hoops. There are, but we have that commitment to make sure that no one that's going to pose a safety risk to our children is allowed access to our children.
But when somebody comes to speak, like an expert comes to speak on vocation day or whatever you would call it, they're not going to be put through that.
No, because really the challenge is you don't want to have anybody that's not in control of span of supervision of the teacher or administrator. So if there's a guest speaker to a class or to a school, they will be under the supervision of a teacher or administrator, so they would not be required to have that. But anytime a potential adult could be around a child, we have to do everything we can to do those background checks.
We're going to talk about the new grading system, school vouchers, and more with Dr. Heath Morrison when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction, East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. The killing of teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, renews questions about police practices and the use of deadly force. So, on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, some say that Brown's death could spark a broader debate in U.S. police strategies. That's coming up in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the schools, well, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Hundreds of thousands of students need cash to pay for tuition, and they're turning to their social networks and strangers to help. Does it work for everyone?
My parents grew up in a culture where it's embarrassing to do that. Like, I think I have tried to tell my parents that in this generation, and you need to put yourself out there in order to get help.
I'm David Gura, crowdfunding for college. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On the second day of school, we're talking to Dr. Heath Morrison, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. We'll share some of the comments that are coming in on Facebook and Twitter and email with you in a second. Let's talk about this new grading system, because yesterday I read about this for the first time. I'm woefully uninformed, I guess. You're rolling out this system that will allow students who score poorly on tests to redo assignments for a higher score. That's a nutshell version of it. Why are you doing this?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was a little surprised that was a front page story. This is something we've been talking about for several years. As a matter of fact, when I became superintendent, there was discussions already. What we've tried to do is to make sure that we give students the opportunity to master material. It's really important that we don't just say, okay, Mike, you didn't learn it, too bad, so sad. We want to make sure that as you're progressing through the school year that you are actually learning at a high level and building on your skills. So,
is this just for tests, retaking tests, or is it for if I had to turn in a paper and I got a D on the paper, I can rewrite the paper and turn it back in?
Tests and assignments, and the idea is very simple. If you do nothing, you get nothing. Okay, if you turn nothing in, if you don't make an attempt, then you're going to get a zero. Mm-hmm. But if you turn in the assignment, if you try on the test, you didn't learn the material, you didn't show that you'd mastered the material, then you have the opportunity to retake it. And then also what was very important we heard from our community, because we've been spending the last several years talking to teachers and community members about this, is that if we both do the assignment and you get a 99 and I get a 60, and I should not be able to come back on the second attempt to get a higher grade than you are. So that's why it's capped at 84%.
So even if I come back and take it again, I can only get a high C.
Exactly.
Even if I get 100% of the questions right, I will only get a high C.
Yeah, and we think that's important.
Then why would I take the test again?
Because there's a huge difference. Think about it this way. If there's two assignments and you get 100 and a zero, okay, then that averages out to a 50. You failed. Okay.
But if I've learned the material, if I've gone back and actually studied enough to get an A on the test, why don't I deserve an A on the test?
Well, again, there has to be part of what we're trying to show is that while we want you to master the material, there's also a huge emphasis on getting it right the first time.
Right.
And so, what we're trying to do is make sure that students don't get discouraged, because what can happen is that a third of the way into a quarter, a student can already almost be mathematically failing the class, even though they're trying hard and they're working hard. So the ability to recover the credits, to recover the opportunity to master the material, we think is really important to keeping our students encouraged.
So how does it work? If I'm a student and I flunk the test or get a D on the test and I really need a C or I really want an A, do I come to the teacher and ask to take the test over? Because I read yesterday that the plan applies to all schools, all grade levels, but not necessarily to every assignment. Who decides which assignments? Decides when a teacher will allow this to happen?
Always the teacher. What's true in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, and it's been that way for a number of years, and really this kind of prompted the conversation, is that schools have a lot of flexibility in terms of their grading practices. And so principals work with teachers. You try to have some uniformity in the school. But we're hearing from a number of community members that, you know, why was it that certain practices were part of one school and not another? So what we really try to do is to create a little bit more standardization across our 164 schools. But at the end of the day, and I'm never confused about this, ultimately a teacher is in control of their grade book. There is nothing that prohibits a student from getting additional extra credit. We know that happens all across our school district. Teachers can have a lot of assignments. Teachers can have fewer assignments. Teachers decide the point total for their assignments. So teachers are always going to be in control of their grade books, and that's rightfully so.
So if I come to a teacher and ask for a redo, they can make that decision as to whether or not I'll get the redo. Because it's more work for the teacher. She has to come up with a new test. He or she has to come up with a new test.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what a teacher might say is, look, you know, rather than do it that way, here's another pathway for you to pursue. You know, a lot of our teachers, I mean, they are phenomenal. They will have after-school sessions. They will have weekend sessions. So there's lots of different ways that teachers are going to be able to make this work.
Will teachers suggest to some students or to some students' parents that they take a do-over?
We hope so. And again, what we try to do was to, we did a lot of surveying of our teachers last year, and we were asking questions about, you know, what is the best way to make sure, and it kept coming back to all the conversations, and as we engaged our principals, what I think everybody really feels strongly is we want to make sure our students master material. It's not about did you get it the first time, it's about did you learn it so that you can build the next skill. It's really hard to learn Spanish 2 unless you really mastered Spanish 1. Mm-hmm. And so much of what we teach in schools is recursive. It builds off of itself, and so before we progress a student through, we want to make sure that they really have a keen understanding of what a student knows and is able to do.
Last week, one of the courts in North Carolina declared that school vouchers, which are used to help parents pay to put their kids in private school, are unconstitutional. These are these opportunity scholarships, but Wake County Superior Court Judge Robert Hobgood said that these vouchers send public money to privately run schools that don't have to meet state standards and fail to maintain the right of the people, these are his words, to what he called the privilege of education by siphoning off money from public to private schools, which can discriminate on the basis of religion. Now, I know you're not opposed to charter schools. Were you opposed to school vouchers?
Well, I'm not opposed to quality charter schools that serve all children and have many concerns about what's happening in our state in that front. Many of our charter schools act like private schools, and so that's a conversation for another time. I've never been a fan of vouchers, and really because I think there is a distinction. A charter school, when it serves all children, is a public school and operates under the same state laws and statutes that all public schools do. Private schools are allowed to pick and choose who they serve. Private schools are allowed
Aren't charter schools allowed to pick and choose
who they
serve?
Well, again, not all charter schools. In North Carolina, we've created some pretty interesting ways that we do charter schools that are very different than many other states. But I think when you poll citizens, and there's been a lot of polling of individuals, citizens in North Carolina, even parents who are the biggest advocates for school choice are not advocates for public dollars going to private institutions. And so we have some great private schools here in the Charlotte region. But if you're going to take the public dollar, then you should have to accept all of the public, and you should fall under the same tests and assessments and all the other requirements of a public school. So you shouldn't be able to take the public dollars but then sidestep all the other things that public schools are tasked to do.
How much money would this have siphoned out of the public schools?
You know, that's hard to say because we haven't seen an updated list of who signed up for the opportunity scholarships. What was set aside in the budget last year was around $10 million. There was an additional, I think, $9 million or $900,000 added in this budget for the potential of allowing everybody that wanted an opportunity scholarship to get one. So across the state, it was between $10 and $11 million budgeted.
And I suppose if you're a parent who had planned to send your child using a voucher to a private school this year, this decision last week before the first week of public school began would have thrown you into a tizzy, because particularly if you really couldn't afford to fund that child's private education. So what impact will that have on you? Are people coming back to you because they can't now use these vouchers?
Well, again, you know, we weren't, you don't know until someone actually tells you I'm going to withdraw from your school. So I don't know if there was anybody that had planned to use the opportunity scholarship that was going to leave one of our schools. We haven't heard that so much as we have had a number of parents bringing students back from charter schools, and we're encouraged to hearing that. But again, until we actually saw the roster of who potentially was going to access the Opportunity Scholarship, it's hard to say how many students we were going to lose. I think what was challenging through that whole discussion was when the first court ruling happened, I think a lot of individuals across the state thought that there was going to be not moving forward with the program, but then there was a decision to go ahead and move with it, even though it was in question in the courts. And so I feel sorry for any parent at this point, this close to the start of the school year, who thinks that a school is going to be available and all of a sudden it's not there. So,
a couple of emails that have come on as we've been talking here. Let me share a couple of them with you. We moved to Charlotte recently just so that we could send our children to the Waddell Language Academy. We've been very happy with the school since there is a healthy waiting list each year, enough to fill several additional classes of kindergartners each year. Why not create more immersion language academies, and why not add immersion preschools and continue the immersion through middle school and into high school? That's the first of two questions here.
That's great. If you just want to feel great about education and see just an extraordinary learning environment, E.E. Waddell Language Academy, just phenomenal things happening there. And we are in the process of expanding those options. We're surveying the parents at E.E. Waddell to see if they'd be interested in a continuation through high school. Right now it serves up through eighth grade. I was just at West Mecklenburg High School, which is one of the continuation schools for if your child ends up going to high school from E.E. Waddell, that in South Meck. We are rapidly expanding programs such as our STEAM schools, Montessori, language immersions. We really want to be responsive to those other opportunities that our community is asking for.
Second question in this series of questions was, what was the issue with teacher visas in the spring? A classroom headed by a non-native speaker of the target language simply cannot compare to a classroom headed by a native speaker. Is that settled?
Yeah. So the challenge is, you know, as much as you love immersion programs, the challenge is you have to find a great teacher who is able to speak in a different language. Mm-hmm. That's the whole purpose, is you don't want just a good math teacher. You want a good math teacher who's conversant in the language. And having a native speaker is phenomenal in an immersion program. What we're challenged with in terms of is that there was one sourcing of those teachers, and I was actually at one of our language immersion schools yesterday, and we were talking to the principal. And the challenge is after a certain amount of years, those teachers have to return to their native countries. And so keeping that continuity is very challenging. We went to a different sourcing of teachers, and so far we're pleased with that. We're checking in with our principals in terms of how they're feeling about this new sourcing. And so it's different, and like any time you do something different, there are going to be some issues. But overall, we're pleased with the new way we're acquiring our teachers for our immersion programs.
Jenny has a comment and a question about school supply lists. She says they're torture. I certainly don't want teachers to spend their own money, but the lists are getting out of control. Does CMS really not have enough money for school to buy their own copy paper?
You know, I think what happens is that a lot of teachers have different things that they want to do in terms of materials. And so if a teacher is going to step out of the norm in terms of the supplies for materials, they may ask for that. That's something I'm not a fan of asking for. And so if that individual wants to email me at the superintendent's account, I'd like to follow up on that and see what we can do.
Okay. Al emails, this is the most politicized school situation that I've ever seen. I've lived in three states and have known educators in all of them, and I've never seen a bigger fiasco where it comes to the way the state treats teachers. My wife is a teacher here in town, and it's my opinion after observing this short session and now the political ads that are out touting that certain candidates are pro-education, that the General Assembly should be ashamed of themselves. I know you're not going to comment on that, so we'll move on. Xenia on Facebook says, what hurts worst about teacher pay is the discrepancy in teacher pay and other CMS employees that don't do half the work that teachers do.
You know, let me say something about our we are low in teacher pay compared to other states. We are low in principal pay compared to other states. We are low in terms of secretary pay. We're low in terms of executive team. As I've tried to hire community superintendents, and these folks support schools that are bigger than some of the school districts in North Carolina. There are principals in Montgomery County, Maryland, which are very familiar with middle school principals that make far in excess of our community superintendents. So throughout our school district, there's a disparity.
Oh, but it costs more to live in the D.C. area.
Yeah, but I'm not talking a little bit. I'm talking a huge disparity. You know, one of the realities, and I kept on trying to say this during our legislative session, we're 48th in teacher pay because we rank 46th in how much we spend on education per student. And so you can't just move the needle on teacher pay and think that you're going to dramatically increase support for public education.
What do these other states spend the money on? I mean, because if you walk into most of our schools, I would think, they're not falling apart.
No.
They're not shabby. The teachers have supplies. There are modern conveniences and bathrooms, and they have athletic facilities. So what are these other states spending the money on that puts us 46th? And what are their schools like?
Well, remember, most school budgets are 85% people. So it's how many people and how much you pay them. So one of the big disparities, obviously, is the pay, not
just
for teachers.
Are those kids getting a better education as a result of being number one or number five or number 10 in education?
We are both familiar with Maryland. It ranks either one, two, or three every year in terms of how much it spends. And every year it ranks one, two, or three in terms of educational academic progress and excellence. What I'll say is in North Carolina for many, many years, we've ranked in the low 40s in how much we spent. And in terms of most of the measures that you use to say how's the state educating their children, we rank in the top 10 to 20. So the return on investment the state has had for education in K-12 for many, many years has been incredible. But most of our citizens in North Carolina don't realize we rank 46th in terms of per student expenditure. And so until we address that, we might move the needle on teacher pay, but we're doing it by impacting the per student ratio.
Brandon emails, what's happening with Oakhurst Elementary in 2015? Will neighborhood children get automatic entrance in the new STEM school?
Yeah, we're excited. We're reopening Oakhurst up as a STEAM school, science, technology, engineering, arts, and the math. We're having conversations right now with the community in terms of should it be a partial magnet or a full magnet. We have tremendously overcrowded schools in that area of our district, and so we're bringing a recommendation to our school board in November about Oakhurst and look forward to a lot of community involvement and engagement in those discussions.
Kristen emails, how many children crossing the border have ended up at CMS schools?
You know, the thing about when people ask that question, we don't know because we are not allowed to ask. And so we know we've seen a tremendous amount of new registrations. And so I'm sure that we have a significant number increase in terms of students. But again, that's one of the federal rules. We don't ask that question. We're not allowed to ask that question. So when people want an answer, I can't give you an answer because we can't ask that question.
I thought Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. There are
different topic.
There will be fewer out-of-school suspensions this year. So what happens if a student is acting up and causing a problem that would have resulted in out-of-school suspension? What happens to that?
There is nothing that's going to say that there's going to be fewer out-of-school suspensions. What we have looked at and we've worked with our principals on is to say, you know, the whole concept when you and I were growing up, getting a suspension from school led to consequences at home. You know, nowadays, many of our students, when they're suspended, they get a day at home with their Xbox and right. TV and food. So we're looking at different ways to address challenges and problems. We want children to exhibit good behavior at school, but a suspension may not be the most appropriate way to have that discipline administered.
Didn't get to talk about personalized learning or principles.
Next time.
Dr. Heath Morrison, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, thank you for the hour.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Charlotte.